Hello again. I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 29th of May. Minority children in foster care have been hurt by a federal law that plays down race and culture in adoptions. This report done by the Evan Donaldson Adoption Institute, a nonprofit adoption advocacy and research organization based in New York, says that the impact of the law over a decade shows that minority children who are adopted into white households face special challenges and that white parents need preparation and training for what might lie ahead. This organization, as well as several child welfare organizations, including the Child Welfare League of America, the Adoption Exchange Association, the National Association of Black Social Workers, the Voice for Adoption, and the Foster Care Alumni of America, have endorsed the report. Our guest this hour says that the idea of being colorblind is great, and we'd all like to get there. This is Adam Pertman, who is the director of the agency that did the report. But these children often face major challenges as the only person of color in an all-white environment trying to cope with being different. The reality is that we live in a very race-conscious society, and that needs to be addressed. We simply can't pretend that the problem doesn't exist and leave it up to the child to cope. Adam Pertman is executive director of the Evan Donaldson Adoption Institute. We'll be welcoming phone calls, and I'm sure that many of you live in families who are listening to us where there are people of color who have been adopted by white families, and also we've heard from families of color who have adopted white children too. So it would be interesting to hear from you about the preparation that may be needed and whether or not it's race and culture should be taken into consideration. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. If you're joining us in Milwaukee, it's 414-227-2050. The email is talk@wpr.org. Hi, Adam. Thanks very much for being with us.
Well, it's my pleasure.
Tell me about this federal law that plays down race and culture in adoptions. What is it? Why was it adopted?
Sure.
When was it adopted?
Sure. Hey, I'll make it short. The law is called the Multi-Ethnic Placement Act. It was adopted about a dozen years ago, and then amendments to it were made a couple years later. The amendments are important because the amendments took the original law, MEPA for short, as long as we have a whole program we can say that. It took MEPA, which allowed race to be a consideration, not the consideration, because no one wanted that, but which allowed race to be a consideration in child placement from foster care, and took that out so that it can be no consideration. Race can play no role. So it essentially says adoptions from foster care have to be colorblind. The reason the law was passed, in a nutshell, is because there were some kids, not a lot, but there were some black kids who were in foster care who were remaining in foster care while caseworkers were looking for black families for them when there were white families available who wanted to adopt them. So the kids just lingered when there was an opportunity to put them in a loving home. And people said, that's not right.
Mm-hmm.
Transracial adoption is fine, and we believe that as well. And so the law was intended to, the theory of the law was, if we don't see race, if we don't allow race to play a factor, then these kids will get homes more quickly. And that was the bottom line. A dozen years later, though, just in a nutshell, we don't see that. The movement of kids, of African-American kids from foster care into permanent families through adoption is slower than for any other race. The number of black kids in the general population of children in America, there are 15% of all children in America are African-American, but 30% plus of all the kids in foster care are African-American. So we haven't done the job for them. And what our report does is look at that dozen years, what worked, what didn't, and suggests how we might be able to do it better.
So it suggests that you're not getting enough white families who want to adopt, or black families.
Or black families. This is a pivotal point that's often overlooked. One of the principal portions of the MEPA law was a mandate that there be active recruitment from the communities from which these kids come. In other words, if there's a disproportionate number of of black children in the system, then you need to do recruiting of black families. That doesn't mean they're the only ones who are going to adopt. You're just trying to increase the pool. And there are white kids in the system, by the way, and African American and Latino kids. So you're supposed to be recruiting actively all of those. But that part of the law has not been well enforced. So we haven't grown the pool of potential parents in the way that the law envisioned, but we have imposed this colorblind standard that is more, it really has impeded so much children from getting homes as preparing those parents who are white for the experience that their children are going to have in life by giving them resources, by giving them training, by telling them what issues in race, relating to race, racism, identity, culture, their children might face so that the children simply grow up in a better home.
And what do they face? What do those children face?
Well, the children face the same thing that anyone of color does in America. There are some issues that are just race-related. There are some issues that are certainly racism-related. We tell, it's not a unique story. It's one African-Americans can tell you every day. But, you know, we tell about kids who are followed in the store, black kids, and they go home to their white parents who really don't know how to tell them how to cope with this. Mm. It's out of their experience. So what we're suggesting is that if we as white parents don't have that experience, don't have that education, if you will, then maybe we need to get it to do a better job in raising our children. And this law, MEPA, forbids us from being from getting that education because it would not be colorblind.
Oh, I see. So they're getting no education at all.
The only way MEPA permits training of parents adopting transracially is if all of them get it, because that would be colorblind. So, in other words, if there are 10 parents in the room, 5 are black, 5 are white, the 5 black ones are adopting black kids, the 3 of the 5 white ones are adopting white kids, and 2 of the white ones are adopting black kids. Those percentages are pretty close, by the way. Hmm. You can train them all. You can train them if you train them all. So you're training black people how to raise black kids.
I see.
You're training white people who aren't adopting black kids how to do so.
Right.
In order to train those two. But if you segregated those two and said, here's what you need to know, let's have a discussion, you can't do that under federal law.
Oh, that's interesting. That doesn't make a lot of sense, does it? Because there are a whole different list of considerations. Because there's racism in our society. It's not colorblind yet.
And it's not all racism. You know, there are identity issues.
Right.
There are culture issues. There are issues these kids will face growing up. And it simply makes sense that if we're going to have multiracial families, and we're fine with that. Some people are saying, oh, so you're saying that there should be race matching. No, we're not saying that.
Right.
We're saying that if you do adopt transracially, there are things you might want to know to be a better parent.
Right. Now, tell me these figures again, because what I've heard was substantially different, that the number of African-American children who stay in foster care who could be adopted by white families is actually very large.
Well, it's a little bit complicated. Our report, just so everybody knows and they can see it for themselves and get all these numbers, it is on our website, which is adoptioninstitute.org, and then you'll see the whole report with all the breakdowns. It's 60 pages, and it's a little dense. The writing isn't, but it refers to scores of studies, and some of them are. So the answer to your question is a little bit, because there is a disproportionate representation of African Americans in foster care. There's no doubt about that. It's about double what their representation in the child population at large in the country. So there are a lot of, still mostly white kids in foster care, but it's not. But they're less represented. So there are white parents adopting those black kids, and there are black parents adopting those black kids, and probably Latino. I mean, it's everything that you can imagine is happening. We don't have enough of them. And what the research shows is as the kids get older, they get, and especially the kids of color, it gets harder to place them in homes. You know, by the time they're 7, 8, 12, it gets harder and harder. And, again, you have to extrapolate from research, and you see who people want to adopt. And you see that that white folks want to adopt younger children, especially when they're of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you have to sort of add two and two, and you get to the place where you say we need more black families because they are the ones who are more likely, not exclusively, more likely to adopt the kids who are available in foster care who are older and of color.
I see. And how are the recruitment efforts taking place, Adam?
Well, there's recruitment all over the country in one form or another. You see it during National Adoption Month, during National Foster Care Month, which, by the way, we're in right now. And, you know, there are billboards or TV. There's all sorts of recruitment out there. What they haven't done is this focused, let me back up. There is a brand new grant proposal from the federal government, the first time in years and years and years, that actually says that actually provides relatively small amount of money for pilot programs in a handful of states to do diligent recruitment. That's the wording in MEPA, diligent recruitment of for foster children, and that's really aimed again at the populations from which these kids come. So what they're really looking for is more black parents, but all parents. I mean. More is better, and more means these kids have a better shot. But we have not done that over the years, so it has been very generalized recruitment. It has been those billboards, which obviously are for anybody who wants to look at them.
Right.
TV commercials for anybody who wants to look at them. And here's where MEPA gets a little sticky, because if you're supposed to be race, if you're supposed to be colorblind, then you can't go into a black community and say, we need black parents for these children. Because that's not colorblind.
Mm-hmm.
You have to do it more broadly. So the law, again, is well-intentioned, and the supporters, and it continues to have some supporters, say, you know, if we allow race to be a consideration, which is what one of our recommendations, then for many social workers, we risk it becoming the consideration, and it'll hold up the placement of children. That is not the outcome we're looking for,
right.
And we have to put safeguards into place. But it's throwing out the baby with the bathwater to say that for all children this rule will apply, because maybe some social workers will abuse it.
Right. We also live in a society, unfortunately, and I speak to you from Milwaukee, which is one of the most segregated parts of the country. So that you would have substantial problems, I would think, in this community because. A lot of the areas outside of the city are white and very, very white. And inside the city is not. It's African-American and Hispanic. Those are the dominant populations. So it would be very hard to have this colorblind society because we don't have it. We don't have it in our neighborhoods, which, of course, would be ideal.
Yes. You know, the way – one of the ways in which I think about this, because I think about it too much, is that we think about this – generally speaking, through an adult prism. And I'll explain what I mean. Our first recommendation in our report is that we shape, and it seems so obvious that it seems like a no-brainer, we recommend that laws and policies relating to adoption and foster care be first and foremost with the best interests of the child in mind. That's a no-brainer, right? The best interest of the child is most important. But if you think about it, when we shape laws that are, quote, colorblind or dictate how a social worker will function, we're really thinking, or what a parent a parent should or should not receive, because some parents say, why do I need training? I'm a good parent. I can do my reading. Don't worry. I'll take care of my
kids.
Just give me the kid. We're really there looking at the world through an adult prism. What do the adults want? Let's have a debate about color blindness or color consciousness or what we want to do as parents and what the right thing as social workers. But that's about what the adults do. That five-year-old kid is going to be riding on a bus and hearing some really nasty stuff. And if you don't get the training, dear adult, you might not be able to answer her questions when she comes home crying. So if we put the interests of the kid first, and the real life experience of the kid first, then we come to different conclusions, and hopefully we do some things better.
Mm-hmm. What's been the experience of the country in having African-American families adopt white children?
I think it's fair to say that happens minimally.
Uh-huh.
I think it happens minimally. There lots of people raise racism questions in that regard. And I think certainly we need to think about whether there are elements of that. But for the most part, I think it's because the white kids stay in their – the model has always been, and I think viscerally people have always thought that you stay within your community. Now, that's radically changing, obviously, partly through adoption, intermarriage. I mean, our country has become much different. But historically, I think that has been the case. And there have been sort of enough white folks for stepping up the bat to adopt the black the white children who were available. Now, again, that's changing. But there haven't been enough black folks stepping up to adopt all the black children who were available. And that was the impetus for MEPA when it was implemented, because we didn't want to leave the kids sitting there waiting for what somebody might have thought was an ideal family, because we know sure as heck that staying in temporary care is not ideal for anybody.
Right.
But again, it's really changing, and I think that one of the reasons why the time is right for making this change in law, in federal law now, is because we really have made advances in this last dozen years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't live in the same place we did. I'm not saying we live in an ideal place. We certainly don't. But, you know, we've got an African-American who's probably going to be the Democratic nominee for President of the United States. There are a lot more multiracial families now than there were a dozen years ago, partly because of adoption from foster care, partly because of adoption from other countries, and partly because of intermarriage, because this is where we're going.
It is changing, isn't it? It is visibly changing in this country.
And we have to recognize that that's true.
The Associate Commissioner at the Administration for Children and Families at the Department of Health and Human Services said, "I have not seen any research which suggests that federal law has not been beneficial to minority children."
Well, I guess, when did this commissioner say this?
Recently.
Well, before or after Tuesday, when we released that report. That's all I can ask. I mean, it's a pretty thoroughly done document. People can certainly reach different conclusions. But I think that the research is there, and we can say, and we can make conclusions from it. Again, other people can disagree. And there are people who say, well, you know, this may be true, but it's a slippery slope if you allow race to be a consideration. That's not the ideal world we're shooting for. That is a slippery slope, because what if it means, you know, social workers will hold up placements to get that black ideal family? So I understand the, quote, other side of people who have concerns, but I think the research is certainly there.
We welcome phone calls for Adam, and we'll take them in just a moment. Adam Pertman is our guest, executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. They released a report just a little while ago, and it looked at minority children in foster care being hurt by a federal law that plays down race and culture in adoptions. The report, based on an examination of the impact of the law over 10 years, saying minority children who are adopted into white households do face special challenges, and that white parents need preparation and training for what might lie ahead. And the report looks critically at the Placement Act, which was put together, what did he say, in 1994, in which it was said, federal law, that race and culture should not be a consideration when it comes to adoption. So what do you think about all of this? I'm sure, as he said, the world has changed quite a bit in the last 12 years or so. Many of you are living in families where there has been intermarriage, where there is transracial adoption, where you have had foster children. What's been your experience? Do you think that a special kind of training is needed? Do you think that race still is a consideration? If we had an ideal world, a culture in which color blindness was the norm, but because it isn't, does it make some sense to move toward having African-American families adopt and have foster placement for African-American children and white families adopting white children? What do you think about all this? Well, here's the number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, Milwaukee, 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, let's go to phone calls for Adam. We start with Bo from Milwaukee. Hi, Bo.
Hey, how you doing?
All right, how are you?
Good. Good morning, Kathleen. Good morning,
Adam.
I'm sorry, I'm a little nervous here. I just...
don't be nervous. It's just Adam and Kathleen.
You'll be all right.
Right.
I just had a few comments. I'm a black man, and I have kind of a lot of different background, I guess you could say. I don't want to be too long-winded, but I went to University School in Milwaukee, and where the black population wasn't too high. And I have a conversation with my wife quite often. Well, not quite often, but every now and again on a couple of issues about black people and the children. We have three interracial children, and my wife is a white American, and one of the conversations that we have is hair care for our children, being that the thing is that it gets overlooked a lot, and that's kind of what
you're absolutely right.
Huh?
You're absolutely right. It shows just the gamut of things that a white parent. Some people say, so you're saying they have problems if they are in a white home. No,
exactly.
They may just have issues if they're in a white home. The white parent might want to know how to take care of the skin and hair. So
exactly.
It can be small and large.
And that I think definitely that's one of the biggest things, you know, because, dealing with my family, you know, there are some misconceptions, you know. It's like, you know, she wants the kids to wash their hair every day. And I'm like, you can't do that, you know what I mean? Because it's damaging to the black hair.
Huh.
And another issue that I'm sorry.
No, it's fine.
No, this is
interesting.
What we need to hear.
Right.
Is that, you know, she asked me too, like, you know, do you like to be called African American or do you like to be called black? And I thought about it and I did some research on it. And it seems as though when people call you African American, it's almost irritating. It's like, you know, call me black because I'm just as American as you. And, you know, you don't hear too many people calling white people European American or, you know, otherwise. I told her, just call me black, you know. I mean, I guess you could call Barack Obama African American because he's, you know, half American, half African. I told my kids, call me Jamaican if they want to call me, you know, if they want to really specify, because my mother's Jamaican and my father's from America. But for the most part, I just wanted to make those two comments, and I'll take your guys' response.
Thanks, Bill.
I mean, I'll just give 2 cents. I think he's just reinforcing that, in fact, we, you know, when we do this, we should be providing some information, some resources, so parents can do a better job with everything from hair to that ride on the bus.
Thanks, Bill, for the call. Peggy is next from Comstock. Hi, Peggy.
Hi. My question is, how does this relate to Native American children? I mean, we're just talking about black
Good
and
question.
White so far.
Good
and I
question.
Know there was, in my college studies, I was taught that there was a preference always given to Native American families for Native American children because of the cultural thing.
You are correct, and our report does go into that. It's the primary focus of the report is on African-American children because there are just so many of them who need homes. So we focus primarily on it. But the report looks at the gamut of kids in foster care and the laws that that relate to them. So the other two laws, federal laws, that relate to the adoption of children of color from foster care are one, a separate law that deals with Native American children, and it does exactly what you're suggesting. It gives preference to Native American parents and tribes and communities, and then then stipulates how to keep the kid connected to culture if the child is indeed adopted out of the community. So it's very, very different. In fact, contradictory to the federal law that governs the adoption of African American children from foster care. The law, the other federal law relating to adoption of children of color, it relates to the adoption of children from other countries. That federal law also contradicts the one dealing with African American kids from foster care. it says that you have to have 10 hours of training in issues relating to race and culture, et cetera, if you adopt from other countries. So only this, only MEPA says that you can't. All the others say you have to.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Thanks, Peggy. Here's an email, a little long, but the other side of the issue. I've been looking into adoption recently. We'd like to adopt a sibling group. We're coming up to so many hurdles to adopt children in need of love and families that we're getting discouraged. These are educated people who understand the culture differences and race issues that people go through, but it breaks my heart knowing that the mixed-race children I would like to adopt may never be able to come live with us because of their race. It seems that in trying to protect the children, these people are in fact contributing to the detriment of their upbringing by not allowing them to have a secure and loving home, regardless of color. It seems that a loving home is more important than perpetuating race issues and continually pointing out to a child who only wants a home that he or she can't have a home with a person because they are not the right color. This from Juliet.
Whether the federal law should be changed or not, it sounds like it's being broken here. I mean, if this person has knowledge that these children are not receiving a home because of a race issue, that's simply, I mean, one might argue it's immoral, but it's certainly illegal and doesn't serve the kid very well. I mean, whether we change the law or keep it, situations like this, I mean, we don't know the details, right? So
right.
I can't really address them. But, of course, color should not prevent a child from getting a home. Nothing should prevent a child from getting a home. And we're not doing our jobs as practitioners, as professionals, if we're as human beings, if we're holding that up.
Yeah. How do you, though, Adam, it would come down in some ways, if we're going to be somewhat colorblind, which we like to be, how do you determine which family is going to give the more loving home? And or a better question is, how do you determine how important culture and race should be?
Sure. And that's the potential slippery slope that people are concerned about and that I feel strongly that we're going to need to put safeguards in place and have rules, guidelines, sanctions. You know, it doesn't happen a lot, but we don't want infractions. We don't want kids to suffer. I can only give you a generalized answer, and I'm not a practitioner. We're researchers. But the answer is that social workers, the people who do child placement as a professional, as professionals every day, are trained in this. And they do make judgments. They make judgments placing children from foster care. Forget race. If a kid has a special need, a learning disability, a developmental issue, a physical issue, they make judgments every single day. You know, this family seems to get it on this developmental piece, and she's, took a psychology course in college, and they have another kid who has ADD, and they seem really well prepared for this child. They make that judgment for kids who have, you know, special needs. I'm not saying race is a special need. I'm saying that the professionals do make judgments to try to help match parents with the right kids, or the right kids with the parents, to put it the other way, so that the children's needs can be taken care of by those parents. And what we're suggesting is the race be one of those factors. So, I mean, just to give an abstract example to make the point, there's a black 5-year-old, and there's a family who lives this is really a blatant example, but just to make it,
sure,
make the point. And there, here's a family who lives in a multiracial neighborhood, who have lots of black friends, and they want to adopt this kid. I'll just make it simple. And here's another family who lives in an all-white neighborhood, and actually we cite an example like this from real life, who says that they really prefer that their kids not play with black children because they can have a bad influence, and they want to adopt this kid.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that's a pretty stark example.
Right.
But the social worker is probably going to make a judgment, and the latter couple is probably going to be angry that they didn't get the kid.
Mm-hmm.
But that's the social worker's job.
Mm-hmm.
What we can't allow is for the social worker to say, well, you know what, the best thing would be for this kid to be in a black home, so we'll just leave him in foster care for another 6 months while we find that family.
Right.
And that's the slope you don't want to go down. But there have to be professional judgments.
Peggy, thanks for the call. Let's go next to Patty. Hi, Patty.
Hi. I just wanted to mention that we have two children, intercountry adoption, and they're 8 and 10 now. And not to forget, to help with some of the culture, your universities are great resources. We've had three students over the past years from China come to, and be part of our girls' lives and to teach them about their culture and to just have an adult to connect with that they might be able to ask questions to that we cannot answer. Mm-hmm. And just to have the role model. And then they bring so much to us as parents in how to help with the kids as things come across their, you know, the daily things at school that nothing really terrible has happened so far, but a few things have come up, and it just gives us a tremendous resource. But I want families to remember the university is wonderful, and these students love these kids. They can't wait to meet them and show them things and have dinner with you, and you bring so much more to the whole situation.
Now, these are students from China at the university? Or?
They could be from China. The last one we had, she was Taiwanese.
Uh-huh.
But we're trying to find students who are from that area of the world. Mm-hmm. And it brings so much to our family.
Adam.
Terrific. I mean, there are lots of ways different parents do this differently. It's just a good illustration of that you need to understand that your child needs to feel comfortable in her own skin. And how we do that can differ. And in respect to MIPA, because there is an analogy here, we're saying that the same sorts of thinking that your caller just said is real in her life should be what other parents consider, what parents should consider when they adopt, white parents consider when they adopt African-American kids. We're not telling, nobody should tell them how to be parents. You can do anything you want to do once you're the legal parent of a child. But we're saying that you should get some information, some education, to say, here are issues you should think about, here are resources you should have, and now make the best judgments you can.
Right. Thank you so much for your call. Let's go to Kim from Eau Claire next. Hi, Kim.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm calling because I was a treatment foster parent for over 20 years.
Mm.
And we had every color of the rainbow of children. The thing about success with kids, whether you adopt them or you're a foster parent, is to do what the last caller says, is get the education that you need so the kids know about who they are. We had several African-American children, and we have some resources that we had African-American friends, and they were buffers for when the children had problems in school. These children were also special needs kids, so they needed more. We also ended up adopting one of our African-American children, and how we've worked through that, being that we're Caucasian, is that, you know, we do Kwanzaa, we do other activities, and when we had other children from, like, let's say American Indian came, we would find someone from the university that would help us identify with that child. And I don't think there's more resources out there for these parents than people are thinking there is. And I agree with Don that, you know, you need to honor who they are. Honor, you know, if they're African American or if they're, you know, even if they're mulatto, that doesn't mean that they're white or they're black. They need to find mulatto children or mulatto mentors. And you know, we've had quite wonderful experiences, along with several difficult experiences, but not related to the race.
Mm-hmm. Adam.
Yeah, I think we reinforce the same point over and over. It's really important to keep our kids focused and comfortable with who they are so they grow up with the healthiest identity that we can help them have. One thing that is worth thinking about is that when we marry someone of a different race or ethnicity, we don't think that we fully recognize that we are now a multiracial, multiethnic family, and it becomes a blend of those elements of the husband and the wife. It, you know, sometimes one dominates, sometimes one doesn't. But we certainly don't think, oh, well, I'm now a white person and I happen to have a black husband. You're a multiracial family.
Mm-hmm.
And the same is true when we adopt kids or give birth to kids who are biracial. We are, when we adopt kids who are different races than we are, just as if we married them, we become a multiracial family. So you have to look differently at yourself and your own education process and your own understanding, because it is now about you and your family and not just about that child who happened to come into it.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, people are getting information just willy-nilly about culture, race?
Well, there are organized programs, and the federal law only applies to entities, agencies that get money from the federal government.
Mm-hmm.
So private agencies, private organizations absolutely can provide such training and do provide such training. I'll bet there are even some agencies, though it's probably far more expensive. There are probably some public agencies that get federal money that provide such training. But again, they have to do it for everybody.
Mm-hmm. Right.
They have to do it for everybody. So that's a lot of resources. If you have a minority, and you have a minority of your clients invariably doing transracial adoptions. But if you want to do the training, you have to do it for everybody.
Yeah. Thanks very much, Kim, for your call. Let's go next to Dave from Wisconsin Rapids. Hi, Dave.
Good morning, Kathleen, and good morning to your guest. My wife and I are the grandparents of, soon to be four adopted children, three now. And the two eldest are brother and sister, and they're mixed race, African American and Caucasian. And when they were younger, you know, it was almost, things almost were unspoken about it, because they seemed to fit in. And in fact, our grandson, who is the eldest, one time told me that he looked just like his dad. And of course, he doesn't. He's more African-American looking. But now they're getting a little bit older. He's in middle school. They live in a town where there is almost no African-American culture. And I've expressed a concern, and I know that our son and his wife have some information on this and anticipate some things that they may have to do and may not wish to do or should not do. But as grandparents, for example, we bought our granddaughter a doll when she was about four, I think, and it was an African-American doll, and she's quite dark. And she didn't want to have anything to do with that.
Yep.
Huh.
And we felt kind of bad because but she didn't even see herself, I think, as African American. She's just part of this family, and I'm wondering if there are any resources for grandparents.
Hmm.
There are resources for anybody who wants to grab them. I do urge you to look at the report. I also, forgive me for the plug, but I write about this in my book, which is called Adoption Nation. And one of what you reminded me of, the reason I brought up the book, was a story I tell in I think there are two different stories. One of an African-American child with white mother, and the other a Korean woman who was raised by white parents. And both of them had this commonality, and that is that they grew up hating to look at mirrors because they wanted to see someone white looking back. And so there's a problem in a nutshell. That's not good for anybody, and that's certainly not how we want to raise our kids, but it's understandable that a child who grows up in a white culture, in a white home, who only sees white people, everybody wants to be part of their family, of their surroundings. They want to be like everybody else. And they are like everybody else, but we haven't exposed them to that and given them the resources to feel comfortable in their own skin. And that's what we need to do. The direct answer is Google is your friend. There are lots of resources out there for dealing with issues like you're describing. There are books and there are pamphlets and there are, lists and all sorts of resources out there, and it sounds like it's worth availing yourself of them.
Could I add one comment, please?
Sure.
At the time that our son and his wife decided to become foster parents. It turned out that they were unable to have children, and so they went to training for this. And I think it was within 48 hours after they finished their training, they get a call. This family was in crisis, and they need to place the two children immediately. So they were just kind of thrown right in on the fly, and it was quite a challenge for them. And they've done a wonderful job. The kids are doing well in school,
and now they have two kids of their own.
No, they've adopted a third one who's Caucasian, and that was another situation where they were originally foster parents for almost 3 years before they were able to adopt, and after 3 years there was no way that they were going to let these kids go. They were part of their family and part of our extended family, and now they have a fourth who is also mixed race.
Wow.
And they will adopt her. Again, all of these kids came out of crisis situations where they needed a home immediately, mm-hmm. and apparently for the first two, there was not an African-American home
available.
Mm-hmm. So it seems like much of it just happens that way.
Right.
Mm. I didn't hear you, Adam. What were you saying?
Oh, there's the diligent recruitment part of it. I mean, we simply need more families. I mean, it's fine. This is not, you know, I'm delighted for your family, sir. But you know, we need more families. There, too many kids are still in the system
in foster
and not
care.
Finding homes
right.
like your grandchildren.
How important? And thank you so much for your call, Dave. How important is neighborhood? How important should it be as a consideration?
I think more as much for the parents as for the people selecting parents. It simply feels more comfortable for anybody growing up in a neighborhood where they feel comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
And if a child sees people who look like her every day, that risk of looking in the mirror and wishing it were someone else is certainly mitigated. It's not the only thing. It's not always possible because of the community in which you live. But it's the right way to think about it.
More phone calls in a moment. Adam Pertman is our guest. He is executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 227-2050 in Milwaukee. There is a line open for you right now. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Pertman, our guest, executive director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute and also author of Adoption Nation. Marilyn from Milwaukee. Hi.
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 Hello.
Hi. I wanted to say that I grew up in a white, I wasn't adopted, but I grew up in a white neighborhood. And I feel exactly how you were saying those children feel who grew up in white families, because I did not like black dolls. I did not. As a matter of fact, I married a white man. I didn't feel at all connected to the black community. Hmm. I still don't. I'm 50 years old now, and I still don't feel that way.
Your parents were African American?
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
All my relatives are. And I pretty much rejected them in a way. Hmm. I mean, you know, I still love them, but I rejected, you know, the African-American community.
Hmm.
I don't feel at all connected to it.
Hmm.
So I don't think it necessarily has anything to do with the parents being white. It's the environment that you grow up in.
Well, except that if your parents are white, that defines the environment from the get-go, right? So that becomes your environment when you're a kid. That becomes your environment from the start. I'm not sure where the lesson here is, other than environment matters,
and
that's the bottom line of what we're saying in the study.
I didn't hear you, Marilyn. What?
I think the environment is more important than the parents being white.
Hmm.
So you're arguing, you're making the argument that a neighborhood is important, for example.
The neighborhood would make a difference in the child. You know, the type of, you know, the child that's growing up. I mean, if you're African American, it doesn't matter if you're in a black family or a white family. The environment you're living in is white, so you're going to feel the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think it should matter whether the white parents adopt black children or not. It's more important what matters is the environment they're growing up in. Hmm.
Thanks, Marilyn. Let's go to Bill from Appleton next. Hi, Bill.
Yes. Hi, Kathleen. I'd like to relate a little bit of my own experience and then provide a concrete resource for people. I'm a white parent of two African-American children. They're age 4 and 6. And one of the things that we did early on is we filled our house with art that is African. And we brought books into our home that include African-American heroes, for example, not just white European heroes that our children are going to learn about in school. We'll also have resources at home that include African-American heroes. One of the things that I learned through a program called UMOJA, BHE, Black Heritage Experience, it's a weekend-long summer camp put on right in Green Lake. One of the many concrete things that I learned about African-American culture, which is going to really be important for our daughter, is that oftentimes, and this relates to one of the first callers, African-Americans, and especially African-American women, will often judge how much a child's mom cares for the daughter child by how well she cares for her hair. And my wife had no idea how to take care of our black daughter's hair. And so to have this experience in working with someone teaching us how to properly care for our children's hair and skin, just that alone has been huge. And that combined with all of the other cultural and social and food, food-related matters of culture is going to help us. And, yes, our children will still have difficulties and will still have struggles, like all children.
Right. We're not suggesting we have panaceas here. We can just do better.
Mm-hmm. Right. Right. Thank you very much for the call. What about the possibility now of this law being changed, Adam? Is that on the horizon?
Well, that's what we're going to work for. I mean, education is the best teacher, right? and we now have a document, this 60-page report, that tries to look at in an objective, research-based way at what's working, what's not working, and what might work better. I think that we certainly will do all we can to put it in front of politicians in Washington because this is a federal law. And I think there are politicians who are certainly receptive to it. We'll see what the presidential year looks like. But if it's not this one, it'll be next. But we will keep pushing for it. And you pointed out all the organizations that are supporters of this report and its recommendations. These are most of the major mainstream child advocacy and child welfare organizations in America. They're going to continue working for it because they, you know, their jobs, unlike us researchers, are to actually get homes for these kids.
Mm-hmm.
This is their work, and they believe in it, and they think they have the ammunition now with our report with which to persuade legislators to change it. So we're going to work very, very hard to try to do that, and I think, you know, the beneficiaries, if we can pull it off, are certainly going to be the kids who need homes.
Yeah. Tom from Shawano, one more caller, about a minute left. Hi, Tom.
Okay, hi. I have a question with respect to the differences of raising a child from a mixed marriage, or what might be called a mulatto, and a child who is adopted by parents who are of the same gender or color. What sort of differences are there in raising these children?
Well, I'm afraid, I'm sorry to do this on your last call, but I'm not a psychologist or a child-rearing expert. I really have to duck this one. I certainly have personal opinions, but that's all they would be. I'm sure there are differences, and I always come to the same place, which is we should educate ourselves about what those are and try to do as best we can with them.
Mm-hmm. You want to give your website so people can get the full report, Adam?
Absolutely. It's www.black which may not have to type in anymore, adoptioninstitute.org.
Adoptioninstitute.org. Okay. Great. Thanks, Adam, so much. Interesting hour.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah.
Anytime.
Adam Pertman, Executive Director of the Evan B. Donaldson Adoption Institute, and they are trying to change the federal law that they that plays down race and culture in adoptions. They say that minority children adopted into white households face special challenges. White parents need preparation and training for what might lie ahead. So thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour, and thanks to John Treader for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. And we welcome Jonathan Anderson, who will be our summer intern here, who will eventually be helping to produce shows and, well, already has done some work for us, and we'll be screening phone calls here as well. Thanks, everybody. I'll be with you again on Monday. Veronica Rickard is with you on Fridays now. And so have a great weekend. This is the Ideas Network.